From Glitch HQ on Riverside Avenue in safe, subtle Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development.
I'm Martha McGarry, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games. For this week's episode, our topics are hub worlds and safe houses and environmental storytelling. And so, if everyone's ready, let's start.
Welcome back from PAX.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that was me. I'm from PAX. Seattle, y'all.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go see any of Seattle, really. I was just at PAX most of the time.
Yeah.
Which was fine, because I saw Reggie, and he saw me. And so we have a mutual understanding. I mean, probably not. Yeah. Maybe he remembers my face. I was joking that, like, you know how, like, if people apparently in your dreams, everybody you see in your dreams are people you've seen at least once in life. He'll like see me in my dreams. Which would be yeah, this got creepier than I thought it would be. But yeah, PAX was great. We showed off Treasure Stack, and it went really well. Nintendo like handled everything for us, which is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So like we just had to show up and talk about the game, and I got to play Smash for a whole 30 minutes, where other people were in line for 5 hours, apparently, to play like 2 rounds of it.
So. Yeah. Which is what? Just a couple minutes?
Yeah, basically.
I don't really know how Smash works.
It wasn't very long. It was like 5-10 minutes.
Right. But so. You got to sit in front. And this was just because you were on the show floor before they opened.
Right. Exactly. Yep. And they had it open. I was like, well, can I play? And they're like, yeah. And
I was like, we got you.
Yup. It was cool. I met Nintendo people and stuff. Mm-hmm. Nintendo served me drinks. That was also weird. but yeah, I had a really good time. It was really fun.
Nice.
Yeah. Also, we have a locally made game released.
Optica is out. Optica made by Gravik,
yes.
And published by Glitch.
Yes.
It's the first game that Glitch has published. It's on iOS and Android. It's a mobile puzzle game. It's super, super good.
It is very good.
I tore through the whole thing. I aced all 70 puzzles.
Dang.
I'm in love with this game, and it's so good. And it's this great... a perspective puzzle. You need to match up you make a line between 2 points around the surfaces of sort of cuboid objects that are all put together. Kind of like think of like the Qbert stage.
Yeah.
It's like you draw across there. But the twist is that there's these little sliders that then change the perspective, and it's sort of optical illusion style. So you can, it's great. Check it out, Optica. We'll put the link in the show notes.
Yes.
Or you can just search for it on iOS or Android.
Yeah.
It's out and I should play. It's so good.
Yeah, it's not expensive or anything either.
I think it's like $3.
Yeah, like $3 for a very entertaining game.
Yeah.
Sign me up.
Yeah.
I already did.
It has been a while since I've played like a real good puzzle game.
Yeah.
And like I remember when Matt brought this to a playtest some time ago and just I fell in love with the concept immediately. Mm-hmm. And I've been seeing it being worked on here, but I haven't played it. I haven't tested it in the meantime. So when it finally came out, I just devoured it.
Nice. I even put my credit card into my phone for this. So y'all better appreciate that. No, I don't know.
It's great. It's a good milestone. It's a spiritual successor to a game that Gravik put out a couple years ago called Strata,
yes,
which is also a puzzle game that it's
also
really unique.
Very, very good.
Very good. Check that out as well. But it's a big milestone because it's the next Gravik release, but also it's the first thing that Glitch has published.
Yes.
So it's support them. Get that game. It's really, really good.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. So what else came out this week?
Spider-Man.
Yeah, oh,
Spider-Man. Spider-Man.
That's whatever Spider-Pig does.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about Spider-Man. So I guess when you listener have this, it's been out for a little while. You've probably beaten it by now if you're really obsessed with it.
Yeah.
But I played like an hour or two of it last night on its release day. And it was sort of interesting because I haven't played like a big console game in quite a while.
Yeah.
And this one's kind of interesting. It looks incredible. Like that's the first thing about it is that open world games tend to be like... It just south of the best looking games on platforms because there's so much of it.
Right.
This game seems to just really be at the pinnacle despite. And I think a lot of that is because it's a first party Sony title. It's exclusive for PS4. Mm-hmm. It's optimized specifically for that hardware. I think that shows through.
Yeah.
I think that, and you know, I don't, I'd like to think Insomniac has, you know, special talents in these areas, but I think any of these AAA studios could, if they can focus on one platform,
yeah.
you can really see that the pay dividends there.
That's true.
It looks amazing. There are so many puddles, you guys.
So many. Apparently not enough.
Despite reports to the contrary, there yeah. are so many puddles. Anyway, the other thing I noticed is, so I started playing this game on hard mode. Like, it gives you an option, like little euphemisms for the difficulty levels are pretty cute.
Yeah.
But I picked hard mode because when I played Batman, the Arkham games, one of the things I didn't like about them, and I liked almost everything about those games, is that, all the sort of like, melee combos and all the gadgets and all of that stuff that you use in the battles, it's just like, elegant system mm-hmm. of inputs and it's confusing and you don't have to learn it.
Yeah, you don't have to learn a lot of it.
None of the game never requires you to be good at that mm-hmm. to beat the game, to even beat the game quickly or well. You can really just mash the, you know, square button and just go to town on these thugs. And what then happens is there are certain parts of those games where they're designed in a way that absolutely require you to know something that it assumes you learned a long time ago mm-hmm. and that have developed a habit for, but you haven't because you'd never really needed to.
Right.
And I think that's an element of bad design. And I thought, well, that's been common to every one of these types of brawl systems that have been inspired by this. And so I was worried about that. So I thought, well, I'll just put it on hard because then I will have to learn this stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm feeling kind of a mixed about it. Like I'm enjoying it. I like the when you finally beat the wave of enemies, it's kind of great.
Yeah.
But also, I think it wasn't balanced for that difficulty. Mm-hmm. So it feels a little, some of the enemies feel a little bullet spongy.
Sure. And
I mean, like web sponge, I guess.
Yeah.
So I'm going to probably toy with that a little bit, but I found that sort of interesting. And then the thing that I'm not really certain about is, like in Batman, there's like tons of thugs all over the place, and there's like story reasons for it, right? They're all escapees from the asylum.
Yeah.
And that makes some story sense, but you kind of in the back of your head, you know, that's just because you need guys for Batman to punch, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In Spider-Man, there's no explanation why there's like 40, 50 guys streaming out of an elevator. Mm-hmm. Like, it just doesn't make any sense at all in the real world of New York that it portrays.
Right.
And I don't know how much of that is like they give extra guys on the higher difficulties or whatever, mm-hmm. but I'm like, that's probably never going to let up. And you just kind of have to let that slide.
Yeah.
You know? Okay. So those are my first impressions. I really like it. The swinging through the city is really fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very realistic because it's very power fantasy. You can basically just hold down the button and continually swing through New York indefinitely.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about like finding an attach point or anything.
Yeah.
Just hold the button and you'll get it. And consequently, there's certainly an algorithm to decide like where to actually attach it to
right.
in the world.
Yeah.
But also it's very forgiving. Like if you're too high in the air and there's no buildings above you, you have to wait until you get a little lower.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't really punish you that much for that. And so it's a little unrealistic. I kind of wish there was more skill to it.
Mm.
But it's a traversal method and I think they wanted to make it as easy and carefree as possible.
Yeah.
But part of me just wishes like, oh, that would be that seems like a more interesting skill for me to learn than the punch and combo stuff.
Sure.
Which is like fine and I'm getting the hang of it. But I really wish there was more of that like being the Spider-Man.
Yeah, do they have like a trick system or something where like you can do different things?
Yes.
And like, oh!
And it gives you bonus XP because all these games have XP now.
Yeah, okay.
So I rolled my eyes when I saw that. But
that sounds kind
of
fun though.
Yeah, there's tons of animations of stuff. And I was telling you guys before the show that like it's a little strange because the animations are so fluid and seamless that sometimes you totally get a disconnect from the character mm-hmm. in a way that the other games of this type haven't done. And there's the benefit is that it just every frame is gorgeous and fluid and natural and it never feels like you're moving like, you know, avatars on screen. It really does looks great. But the drawback is that sometimes there'll be an extra couple of frames where you don't have control or where the animation's taking over.
Yeah.
And it's an indeterminate amount of time. And so you don't have as much of a connection between your hands and the character, which has sort of always been true for these like brawl systems, but it's more so in this. So I'm playing it more. I really like it, and you know maybe I'll have better thoughts on it forward. But
yeah.
Well, if you got so many thugs on hard mode, you're gonna have to have a safe house to go back to.
That's right.
That was kind of low hanging fruit. But.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna talk about hub worlds and safe houses, which it's kind of hard to explain exactly what I mean, but basically. If you've ever played Borderlands, Sanctuary is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The place where there aren't any enemies and there's stuff to do and like that's where you go when you need to like level up, or you need to just have a break from doing the game. Mm-hmm. And I love these places in games. Like, they're my favorite thing. Like, Dylan, my boyfriend Dylan, will make fun of me because I will spend hours just like wandering around the safe area, and mm-hmm. he's like, "So are you just gonna go run around Sanctuary again?" I'm like, yeah. What else do you do in this game?"
Well, there's no little numbers flying off people in Sanctuary, right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, there are so many like places you can try to get to, uh-huh. and secrets, mm-hmm. and I do that in Destiny too.
Yeah,
Destiny 2 also. In the tower and the farm, I just run around, try to jump on stuff, try to see if I can get out of bounds, see if I can get into secret places. It's like one of my most favorite things to do. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would just want to talk about like different elements of different safe houses and hub worlds that I've enjoyed. And then if you guys have ideas, you can also contribute.
You don't want to be alone in this sentiment, is what you're saying.
Yes. Safe house is best place, right?
Yeah.
It's the best.
Pretty good.
So, I think my favorite ones are where you have space to run around. Like, there's open space that you can just go run and jump and be silly.
Yeah.
And I also like when there's like different interesting corners and buildings and different lots of like vertical levels that you can try to jump to, mm-hmm. and like interesting things in the distance that make you want to explore. Mm-hmm. And also I love secrets, like things you can discover
that
it feels like no one else has, mm-hmm. but really everybody who does the explory thing has discovered them, but it makes you feel like you've tricked the developers or something. Like in Borderlands, there's like, there's always boxes full of ammo everywhere.
Yeah.
And like lockers you can go open and washing machines in random places, like up on top of buildings, you can find washing machines sometimes that have,
I go up to the roof when I do my laundry.
Yeah, exactly.
You could dry them up there. I don't know.
I mean, it kind of makes sense. But anyway, but like, they also have these things, like they're called vault symbols, and it's like the logo of the game is like this circle with a upside down V in it. Mm-hmm. Right side up V.
I think it's upside down
V.
Yeah.
And those are scattered not in just in the safe zone, but in all the levels.
Yep.
But they're usually hidden in little spots that you wouldn't have noticed unless you like go around a corner or you go underneath something or whatever. And when you find them, you get badass points. Yeah. And those are always fun to find because then you level up your skills through that. But there's also like in Destiny, your little robot guy can scan things like in the world and then tell you about them. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of stuff that they have scattered around that's like little pieces of the environment that the little robot guy was like, "Oh, looks like Cynthia the mechanic was over here and left her lunch." And so like there's all these little narratives that are like if you go to all the little secret places you can find, this whole story of these not interest like characters that aren't part of the game.
Yeah.
They're just like things they've left behind. Mm-hmm. Which is super cool.
What's nice about spaces like that is that you can do stuff like that in the game proper, but it makes sense in places like that because the player's engaging with them in a different way. They're not like a side. They're not likely to be missed. They're not a distraction from the game. It's you're here for, to walk around and just sort of enjoy this space. So the features that leverage that are best placed there.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, in the first Borderlands, in Firestone, there's a clap. Or I don't know. It's the second one. Never mind. But there's a claptrap in like behind this rock, mm-hmm. and you have to like kind of jump and get out of bounds to get to him, and then he just goes, "Hi," and that's it. But it's still great.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah.
When I think of hub worlds, I don't think of things like Sanctuary, I guess. I think of things like in Super Mario 64, where like you just, this is how you get access to all the other worlds. And I like those a lot because like there's a whole bunch of extra things you can do that like you can just spend a bunch of time in. As it's like you're talking about, it's safe to do all of these things and you can spend a ton of time trying to figure it out or not figure it out or just jump around and stuff.
Yeah, it's a place to try out the mechanics and get a test. Mario 64, because it was like, it was so concerned about teaching you how 3D cameras worked and how like all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like the Princess's Castle was very much had a mechanical purpose as well as a narrative purpose, right? And those are sort of the best versions of that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are really fun.
Yeah. That reminds me of Rogue Legacy, even though it has a very tiny safe zone or whatever before you go into the castle each time, you can like practice all your moves without depleting your mana. So you can just like shoot your spell at people just to see what it looks like and what it would do, but that it doesn't actually cost you anything to do that.
Right, that's a pretty common feature of these things, is like is a training area or whatever, and sometimes it's like couched in the lore. So like all the Arkham games have the Batcave. Even Arkham Asylum, the first one, you had a Batcave. You had a little mini Batcave on Arkham Island for some reason, because they just had to include that. And so you need to have little training pieces.
You can't be Batman without the Batcave.
Right.
It's just true. Where would you sleep upside down then?
Well, yeah, then it's just a man cave.
Yeah.
And that's just sad. So this seems to be a feature that is best realized in 3D games. But in 2D games, it's sort of like the RPG village or something, right?
Yes, yes.
It still is a thing. It's just, it's not, it doesn't always express itself the same way. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering why that is. Maybe it's because you can't, like, because there's no third way to go. You can only go.
Right. It's the 3D games are much more non-linear. Even in ostensibly linear games.
Yeah.
They're, you know, more mechanically nonlinear in terms of like where you actually literally go. Yeah. So it makes more sense to have.
It's also
hubs.
Harder to like hide things unless you hide them behind walls or something.
Yeah.
Because like with 3D space, you can just hide something behind a building. I guess it's the same thing. I don't know. Yeah, I think that like it generally is not the case. Like I guess in Hollow Knight they have stuff, but there's not really a hub. Well, that first village you see, I guess, is a hub world.
The above, it's and it builds up over time.
Yeah,
right. And that's sort of interesting. But like you don't have a lot of incentive to stay there.
Yeah,
I guess. And it's almost irritating to go back there.
Because
it means you've lost.
Yeah.
It's or
like you unlock something and then you have to go back to see the results, and then it's like filled out of your way in a strange. I don't know that it executes it that well.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I wouldn't call that place a hub world.
But I think it is. I mean, maybe it's not as successful, but I think it is as much as anything else.
Okay.
Because it serves the same function.
Yeah, I guess like Super Metroid had that where Samus' ship was. And then you would return to it after a while. And I think that was like a whole moment.
Yeah.
You got back and now like the whole world is open.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
That reminds me of what's that game that's like Terraria except it's multiple people.
Starbound?
Yes. And you get your ship.
Yeah.
And
that's a hub world?
Yeah. And you get to, that has, doesn't that have a little bit of customization in it?
Yeah,
or
you can put whatever you want in there, pretty much.
That's an element of some hub world safe spaces. Not in a lot of the ones I like, strangely, because I do like customizing stuff. But yeah, that's it. Like, for example, Fallout 4, you like make your base or whatever. That one's interesting because you make your base and you like, have all the like craft all these things and have tools and storage for all your stuff like most safe places do, but it also can be attacked, so it's not really safe.
That's interesting. That reminded me of Assassin's Creed 2. I think it was that one where you built up a village in Italy, like from like a little town, and then you'd spruce up every shop and whatever. Of the Assassin's Creeds, you go around whatever city it is and you like you buy up shops and stuff, and but in the one I'm thinking of, you actually just have your own little place, and there are story elements where you do have to it's attacked, but mostly it's a place you can go, and it is a safe house basically. It's just the size of a village. And that's sort of interesting because then it has a little bit of an RPG kind of.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. It's funny. The Assassin's Creed games have an element like that in all of them. Like Assassin's Creed 3 is similar. You have like a homestead that you build up and townspeople you help.
Yeah.
But like they all do it in a different way. They mm-hmm. don't have a consistent thing from thing. And I think the latest ones don't really have that at all. They're totally different.
Okay.
It's kind of strange. It's like they come up with a cool idea around that topic, and then they never stick with it.
Yeah.
It's strange.
Huh.
And then you forget it was part of it because it's not like it doesn't come back, you know?
Yeah.
It just comes back in a different way or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like a Black Flag, you could upgrade your boat.
And, oh, sure.
You know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know. It's sort of different. I don't know.
Yeah. I remember in like Super Mario Galaxy, if you beat the game, you could get a power up that you couldn't get anywhere else in the whole world, the observatory where like you could fly. It was
cool.
Really fun. Yeah, it was really fun. I wish you could do it in other places.
Yeah, that was. I mean, like Mario 64, the observatory was like that.
Mm-hmm.
It changed as the story,
yes,
moved forward. Which,
yeah,
I like that kind of thing where you return to something that slowly and not necessarily. I do like the Assassin's Creed kind of thing or the mechanics where you build it up.
Yeah,
but I also like it when it just as a result of your actions and the game proper, mm-hmm. it evolves as the story progresses. I think that's a really cool expression of it as well.
Yeah, that is so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I like that a lot.
Like, this is a kind of combining both the like taking the the narrative of taking your safe space place away, and then and also changing it based on your gameplay. And with Sanctuary, well, that's kind of a spoiler, but it's been out since 2012. So get on this, guys. Part of the story is that Sanctuary is built on the top of the spaceship or like flying ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so at a certain point in the game, it has to fly away for plot reasons.
Uh-huh.
And so then for like a whole level, you have no way of getting back to it because it's in the air and they don't have like all the whole like right. fast travel system hooked up yet. And you have no idea where they are because they're invisible too for some reason. Anyway, but yeah, when you finally get to go back to it, everything's changed because you're now flying and like half of the city fell off because it wasn't all on the ship.
Yeah.
And the only way you can get off of it is the fast travel because before you could like go out the exits and like,
sure.
So it changes the whole map too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, opens up more levels where it used to be. Anyway, it's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like it if like we did more of that stuff where like you subvert the player's expectations. You come back to this place and all of a sudden there's just a bunch of, I don't know, assassins or something coming to attack you because you're like, oh, this is safe. I can just walk in here, buy my stuff, you know, chill. And then like an assassin comes or something.
It's funny because like there's like Martha, one of the things you like about it is that it's certainty.
Yeah.
Right. So subverting it is really attractive.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting, provides cool moments. But couldn't that also be unsettling to the player who wants the comfort of it?
That's true.
You know?
You'd have to do it.
You just want to goof off in the hub world for a little while,
yeah,
or something?
You'd have to do it in a way, like, I could imagine that happening in a Dark Souls-like game,
yeah,
or something, but probably not in, like, a Mario game.
That would yeah.
Be yeah, yeah.
You'd think I wouldn't like that stuff, but I do like it when it's, like, combined, like, it's, like, encapsulated in a mission.
Sure.
So it's like, yeah. Oh, like, it happens in Payday 2, where you have a safe house, which Dylan never uses. And I'm like, why wouldn't you just go and hang out there? It's weird. But you can like do the practice shooting and stuff.
Uh-huh.
But there's a bunch of missions where your safe house gets taken over and you can't
uh-huh.
use it until you've beaten the mission.
Mm-hmm. Maybe he hasn't beaten the mission yet.
Hey. No, I watched him do it.
So. Oh, okay.
I also love when there's like little mini games in mm-hmm. safe places, like in Destiny 2, in both the safe spaces, there's a soccer game that you can actually play. Like people get together and like kick the ball and then we'll keep score. Well, it won't keep score, but it will like put off balloons if you get it through the one,
either
side.
Yeah.
And that's really fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess it's not really a mini game, but there's a similar thing where it's like while you're waiting for your match to start in Overwatch, you're in those like ship. Some levels have like this the airplanes or whatever that you're in, and there's like a basketball hoop, and so everyone's trying to shoot the bat. Like there's no way to actually like throw the basketball, but you can try to like melee it and like shoot it to try to get it into the basket. And everyone tries to do that, and that's really fun.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Yeah, I'm thinking of like MMOs have this a lot, where like they have the sort of the whatever the headquarters is, whatever for your faction. Mm-hmm. And the I don't have a lot of experience with MMOs, but the one I'm thinking of is Myst Online, which has, you know, the different worlds you would go into, and you know the game really was it's a single player game. They tried to like cram multiplayer features into, but the main sort of area where you could meet up with other people was in this cave underneath Carlsbad, Arizona, and it had a very similar thing where people would play games in it, right? They would they'd invent their own ways of using the limited mechanics that game offered to do things, and then the game itself also did have little mini games and stuff like that in those areas.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and it's where people did the most amount of like voice chat and stuff like that, because that game was much more limited than most MMOs. It didn't have as many mechanics as others did.
Yeah.
That it was that hub world was a really important part of the experience because it was very role playing centric, mm-hmm. More than others have been. So that idea of like using those spaces to play together with people,
right?
Rather than, you know, outside, different from how a single player hub world style thing works.
Yeah.
It serves two purposes, because like it'll gather people together, and then they can set up a game and then play like the main game or whatever outside of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is useful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember I played, Vindictus, a while with my brother, and they had like a campfire place where you get a buff if you just sit there.
Yeah.
So I would just sit there all the time and, you know, get the buff and stuff. And you could just like sit there and like leave your computer on. And I did that sometimes too. But like, I know a lot of people use it to like chat with friends or whatever else, because like while you're there, you might as well do that.
Yeah,
it's got that use.
That's awesome. One other thing that I like about hub worlds is safe spaces, zones. Man, there needs to be one word for this.
Yeah, you let us know.
Before we started the show, you were struggling over to what to call this.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because it's like when I'm talking about hub worlds, I don't mean. Like, I mean the ones like in Mario, those Mario, 3D Mario games where it's like, you know, you just jump around or whatever. It's, but when people say hub world, what I think of is 2D Mario, where it's just like you move to the next like thing on the map. Like, that's not Mario what world, I'm talking about.
Yeah. World map.
Yeah.
World.
But it's interestingly, like in Mario 64, it also does that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're less interested in the hub part of it.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. I'm more interested in like what happens in that spot. Not necessarily like its function at like proper for the game.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So like you were talking about like mini games and stuff like that. Like the new Spider-Man has that, where like
you
go to a lab where you do some work and get some story missions, and it's the safe zone. But the prime example is in like Grand Theft Auto, right?
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm.
So in Grand Theft Auto, like a big part of it is getting enough money to have cooler and cooler apartments to live in and garages to store all your stolen cars in.
Yeah.
and like when you finally get the snazzy upscale apartment that you're like, how is no one questioning how I got all this money? But okay. I'll pay you $1 million. That's fine. Unemployed person.
And there's like so little to do in those places. They're really just about hanging out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You like you can do drugs and drink and watch the TV, but that's literally it. And you like, can change your clothes.
There's some mechanical elements, but like, unlike say like Borderlands or even Mario 64, like it's not an opportunity to really play, like work with the mechanics. Mm-hmm. It really becomes almost role playing in a sense, where you just like hang out on your couch and look at your cool things that you got.
Yeah,
you know, and that's interesting because people do spend a lot of time in those places.
Right,
it's true. And you can invite all the people playing with you over to your house too, which is fun. But
in GTA Online?
Yeah.
Oh, that's neat.
But the annoying thing about it is that every single one is the same. Like I would want it to be like every single one in each tier. I was very disappointed about that. Like no matter what building you get your high end department, it's always going to be the same layout and look exactly the same. I was like, why don't you have like three different layouts? Like even that would have been cool. Like, oh, the couch is over here in this one, like, or it's red or something.
Right,
like,
right.
But yeah, so that's a little disappointing. But in addition to being social with your friends in these spaces,
whatever you want to call them,
hub spaces,
mm-hmm.
hub houses, safe worlds. I like when there's like NPCs to talk to that are, or at least that are wandering around saying funny things, even if it gets a little repetitive when they say the same things. But sometimes you can add like in Borderlands with the Claptrap is always wandering around, and you can high five him and he'll start like doing a little wub 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 dance, and that's pretty fun. There's also like an Easter egg thing that they, there's this guy who really liked the game, but he unfortunately had like a disease that couldn't be cured or whatever. So like as a tribute to him, they put him in the game, and he'll only show up like every so often. But he'll give you like a super cool item, and like,
that's neat.
Yeah. So that's cool things you can do with that.
One I really like is Ghostbusters, the video game, which is basically Ghostbusters 3. You can talk to Janine in the firehouse.
That's awesome.
It's real good. She gives you a ton of sass. It's so nice.
That's great.
I find also there's like a category of safe place that you have to make yourself, base building stuff.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Oh, sure.
Like in Minecraft, like you make your own safe place and you make it as big or small or cool or not cool as you want to.
You have to make it secure, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can make it anywhere. So it can be like on the top of a mountain or just in the middle of a field, and you just put a little fence around yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then like No Man's Sky, I've been playing a lot of that recently because it's actually really good now. You guys, you should all go play it. But they have all this like base building stuff now. So you can go to a planet and be like, hey, this planet is super chill. I want to actually have the game remember this planet and let me go back to it whenever I want to. And so you put your little base thing down, and then you get to build like this whole little safe zone with all these cool like recharge your life support or whatever gadgets, and refine all these minerals down things and places to store stuff and stuff. Yeah. And that's really cool. I just think it's neat to have in some games to have like there's no real safe space, but you make your own.
Right. It becomes a way to make the experience yours. No Man's Sky, particularly because you play that game long enough, at least in its original version, and it starts to feel really samey. And you see between the seams a little bit, and that's okay. But then when they added the base building updates, like it really makes it much more like worth wasting a lot of time in it, because that's all that game is, really.
Yeah.
And the mechanics of actually building it is really like intuitive and interesting. But what was weird for me is I played a lot of that game when it came out, and then it started making really good updates. But by then I'd stopped playing, and I was happy with it. I wasn't really one of the complainers. But I haven't gone back to it, and so I keep seeing all these things. They're really fun. But the weird thing about base building that game to me is I really understood the premise of that game is that you're lost in the galaxy. And that you keep moving forward or moving somewhere. You're an explorer. So having a place to teleport back to doesn't make any sense to me. Mm. Like, it breaks the narrative structure of that game to me, the limited part that there is.
Huh.
But mechanically, it's like it's what saved that game, right? Because people love it. And it's really cool. But like I haven't jumped back into it. It still feels weird. It doesn't feel like No Man's Sky to me for some strange reason. Like, I have this conception of it that's different.
Well, I like that it feels like you're actually getting somewhere.
Yeah.
Now, because it remembers.
You now live in the galaxy.
Yes.
Instead of just like wandering through it. And I think it is now better for it. It's just different from what it was when it launched, you know?
That's true.
And I think that's interesting about these types of places in games, is not just about the mechanics that they offer, but about like what they mean to the larger thing, their existence and how they're put in there, right? Like when we were doing Widget Satchel, we did talk briefly about having like a place that Sprocket can go to stash Sprocket's things.
Oh yeah, we did. Yeah.
I mean, it I'm trying to think like what even that would have been. It doesn't work at all with the mechanics that we ended up settling on.
Right.
But we did talk about it a little bit, and would really change how that game works and how it feels.
Yeah.
And not just about having that as a feature, but like it would change everything else about the game.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, like that definitely impacts. Just having an area in which you do not have to be concerned about like taking damage or anything really does impact like how you feel about the game. Because like if you're like, it's the same way with like Dark Souls, I guess. Like one could consider the safe spaces to be the campfires.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't have campfires, you would always be in danger, and that game would be very different as a result of that. But like because you have campfires, if you take too much damage, like, oh, I'm just going to restart and I'm going to go back to the campfire. Mm-hmm. That is an option.
Well, it also gives those elements stakes.
Yes.
Because if you're always in danger all of the time, then it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Then it's just a really hard platform or whatever. Like that's similar.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have those little places you have to get to,
right,
then it makes it contextualizes all the rest of it.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's probably true for a lot of particularly action games that have these places. It is a reprieve psychologically, right, as well as mechanically.
Yep, yep.
That's why I think it's so interesting games that don't have them too. Yep. Like Sea of Thieves. Mm-hmm. You're all like, even if you're on your ship, if you're on the island like selling stuff, you're vulnerable to anybody coming and stealing your stuff.
Uh-huh.
Like there's no place to go that's, you know, safe from anybody.
Yeah.
So, and that makes that game feel kind of stressful because you can't, like, you just want to be alone. At least that's my part, is like, I see another ship and I'm like, oop, going the other way. I don't want them to take my stuff.
Yeah.
But like, I wish I was a little bit more brave, because there's been some really cool interactions with people who actually embrace the unknown.
Right, right. So do players in that game, like, they approach each other and then they just say hi and then they go away both like nervous? Or is it like every encounter is a battle?
All the people I've run into have attacked me.
So you have a reputation, is what you're saying.
They attack me. That's, I'm like, just there minding my own business, little old lady in her ship, you know, just getting my treasure.
Yeah.
You know, and minding my own business, and they decide to attack the elderly. So I think that's on them.
Fair enough.
But is that how the game is supposed to work, or are there opportunities to just pass like ships in the night?
Yeah, I mean, there's also, that also happens.
Sure.
I've seen YouTube videos of people coming together and like doing little sea shanties together and stuff.
Nice.
And, you know, I try to play music at people to make them like, but whatever, it's fine. Not salty about that game not having a safe zone.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell.
So, Mark, you were wondering earlier, like, what should, if we were gonna make hub world safe places, what would ours be like? I guess you talked about that in Sprocket already.
Yeah, it's funny because I think in the case of Widget Satchel, like right now the construction of the game does not allow for something like that. Like, there's no way it would work.
Mm-hmm.
Before we made some decisions that made it impossible, we did briefly consider it. And so when you think about, like, we've talked, we do this on a lot on the show where we'll say, what would we do when we talk about these mechanics of these systems? I think this one's a little different because it's so specific to the game you're making.
Right.
That's
right?
True.
It's hard to think of like, oh, I would love if I had a thing like this that worked like this. It's like, I guess, but it's, I think more than other types of, brainstorming sessions we've done, I can't really think of any particular thing I would love a hub world to have because it's so dependent on the game more
that's,
than other things.
That's true. That is really true.
Am I letting
us
off the hook or?
No, I think you're exactly right. Like, I'm trying to even think it depends totally on what game you're making. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm thinking about Clawbreaker, like, you could have a stage where you just, like, jump around.
But, like, that defeats the point of Clawbreaker.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
I mean, I guess the ones I like are the ones that are in story-based games where there's a lot of lore to pick up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the ones I'm thinking of are the ones that are based on other properties, like the Arkham games or, like, Ghostbusters, where, like, you learn more about the world and you sort of live in it a little bit. It's a way for you to engage with the story and the world in a way that's different from the game. I like that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Although, like,
I can imagine some people not liking that because it's such a disconnect from the experience otherwise, right?
Well, I mean, it's almost as if the environment of the safe house is telling a story.
Almost.
Wow, you just pulled a trap door out of that topic.
Ooh, and we've fallen into my topic, I mm-hmm. think.
Yes. Safety gone.
Environmental storytelling.
Yeah.
I think originally this topic was going to be environment as mechanics, and I forgot what we meant that to mean. So I decided to change this to environmental storytelling because I know what that means. So, you know, this is that thing where you see words on the wall and they're like, got them or something. I don't know. You know.
The cake is a lie?
Yeah, that. Yeah. The classic Portal Ratman references.
Yeah.
Yes, those kinds of things are mm-hmm. what I'm talking about. But I mean, this can come to form in like many different ways. It doesn't just have to be writing on the wall.
Yeah,
though
yeah.
a lot of games do it, probably too many.
Mm-hmm.
It can also be like the music you're hearing in the background. It could be played on a boombox or something that somebody left there, and you're like, why did they leave the boombox? Or you pick
da 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 da.
Yes, exactly. yeah, so like that. Mm-hmm. Or also like, you know, the pick up the little voice thingies that, you know, talk at you while you're doing other things.
Oh, yeah. Like BioShock is one that, like, I was going to mention it in the hub world because BioShock doesn't have that.
Yes.
And it's interesting.
Really?
And it's interesting that it doesn't. But it has a ton of environmental storytelling
right.
that does a lot of the same things that hub worlds tend to do. Mm-hmm. So these topics really are linked in a lot of ways.
Convenient.
Yeah. But like, yeah, the voice diaries is something that
right.
I think BioShock was, if not the first, was one that really popularized that idea.
Yeah, they practically patented it.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I like it because you can just keep playing the game.
Yeah.
It's cliche now and kind of silly, but like, I think it's fine.
Depends on how they're implemented.
Yeah.
I feel like with voice files specifically, they get on my nerves because I want to sit there and listen to them.
Yeah.
But I also want to keep playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
So like I'm conflicted because I'm like, I want to hear this thing, but if I move on, then I might not hear it. Because sometimes that you can't hear it past.
I was going to say, that's what I hate is when you like, there's like a tape recorder on a desk
on
and
you
press
and you gotta sit there.
And then you have to like, it's like spatial audio. Like if you turn, it moves the speakers. Where it's like, just put it in, let me hear it.
Right,
like,
I'm wearing headphones, come on.
Yeah, exactly. But even then, like when you're just hearing it and they put it in your headphones or whatever, if you're like in the middle of combat and stuff, it's hard to focus on the combat and the talking.
I suppose, yeah.
At least for me.
Well, a lot of times BioShock it tends to put it in places where you're not likely to come up against combat.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I guess there's times when you do, but like they space them out in a way that's deliberate,
yes.
more or less.
Yes. This is an aside, but this is also an issue with like games where like they'll deliver a story to you as you're fighting a character.
Yeah.
Or something, because like if you do really well, then you miss off on like half of the story. and then if you do poorly, then it's just quiet or whatever, and then it's weird. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah, especially if you're like, accidentally overleveled for the thing and you're like, okay, I'm gonna not just run in a circle while I hear their dialogue tree.
I had this issue with Nier Automata. I didn't want to kill nobody because they were telling me stuff and I was like, oh wait, I want to know what
you were just too
about.
Good at that game.
No, I was way too overleveled.
There's Steven bragging again.
Of course. Yeah, so like in terms of like actually doing this yourself, you can be as subtle or overt as you want to be, but like, you know, don't beat people over the head with your narrative.
Yeah.
Narrative.
Unless that is your narrative, in which case do that.
This is the narrative.
Yes.
Look at my narrative.
Exactly. Like I guess we've thought about this a lot in Fingen specifically, like I don't know. We haven't put a ton of effort into it, particularly recently, because we haven't worked on it a ton. But like we have all of the environments have like narratives based off of their game design. So like the kelp forest is my favorite example because like it's overgrown and there's a whole bunch of plants and stuff and a bunch of enemies and stuff that come at you.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the player feels like cramped and like stressed because there's always a bunch of things around, even if they're like not dangerous things. The combination of all of them together makes it feel bad.
Yeah.
So that kind of stuff can be an aspect of storytelling. Really, like you can put anything you want in any aspect of game development, you can put into your environmental storytelling and your storytelling in general. Like even marketing. I'm thinking of what's the name of the Spec Ops: The Line?
Yeah.
They advertise that game as though it was going to be like another Call of Duty or whatever, but it like subverts your expectations as soon as you start playing the game.
Yeah.
I feel like people were probably disappointed if they expected Call of Duty and got Spec Ops. But like but as a result of that, it maybe made that twist more impactful for some players.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Interestingly, like there are games where the environmental storytelling is beside the point.
Yeah.
Right. And that's okay sometimes, but I think that's when you're like, if you ignore it, nothing of value is lost.
Yeah.
And that's kind of frustrating. And then there are games like, you know, BioShock, where it's really like the environmental storytelling is all the storytelling there is, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And so you have to engage with it. And then there are games like most point and click games are filled with tons of little subtle references to a larger world.
Right.
Right. And it that becomes a main mechanic of those games because that a lot of times you're then quizzed on that stuff or it's helpful to puzzles or whatever.
Yeah.
I find that sort of interesting.
Yeah. Those ones are kind of frustrating because of the way point and clicks work. You think that anything could be a clue towards what you're supposed to do next.
Yeah.
And so like you click everything and you listen to everything because anything could be relevant to what
that all sounds great.
Okay, for some. Not for me.
Yeah.
I think it's important to make sure that like the environmental storytelling you're doing is not distracting from the game too much. Mm-hmm. At least to a point where like it's either stressful to like pay attention to it or like you just do not care about it or don't want to care about it. It's a difficult balancing act, I think.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you there. Mm-hmm. I would go further and say it shouldn't distract from the game at all because then it should be part of the game.
That's
right.
A good point. Yes.
Like it should service the game mm-hmm. and if it doesn't, then it's failed.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I agree with that. And also like environmental storytelling is really great if you don't want to make a cutscene. If you mm-hmm. don't have time to make one or you just don't have the means, then you can just, you know, put a toy box in your game instead of like having a cutscene zoom in on the toy box.
Yeah.
I don't know. Game making and such.
Yeah.
I feel like I haven't done a ton of environmental storytelling yet. Mm-hmm. But Mark, you've done a lot of work on this in Widget Satchel, I think.
Yeah. So when we say environmental storytelling, I think the examples, and you cited them, are like, you know, billboards, props you find, like voice that stuff.
Yeah.
But the way we do it in Widget Satchel is there are collectibles in the game, and they're mostly pairs of socks. Sprocket can change their socks through the game, and you need to find these. And there's 30 of them in the game. Mm-hmm. And it's really just a collectible mechanic. But each time you collect one, you get a little piece of text, like flavor text about them. And it's all written from the perspective of like a narrator. And it's in second person. So it's all telling you, Sprocket, what you found.
Right.
And I write them like very with sort of dry humor and then giving hints as to the world Sprocket lives in. So Sprocket is this, you know, pet ferret on a space station who runs away and steals crap and escapes on a shuttle. That's the mechanics of the game.
Yeah.
But you learn about the human characters who populate the station and who, if you pay enough attention, you realize that they are like, that they love Sprocket. They like, you know, that just like if you owned Sprocket and he was just like stealing and breaking crap in your living room, you would love him dearly. Like that's exactly the same kind of thing. So when you find a pair of socks and it says like, you know, this is a pair of birthday themed socks. Mm-hmm. It has a note on it, but you don't know what it says, but the graphic has the note and you, the player can read the note, and it's from one of the human characters to Sprocket, and so
that just warms my heart,
right? And there are pairs of socks that like are like sort of wild and colorful, and then the flavor text says that, oh, you remember seeing these on one of the human characters, and then you find another similar pair, and then they talk, and so you get a hint as to what these characters are like, and again, you can ignore this kind of stuff,
right,
and just enjoy it for being kind of silly,
yeah,
but the more, the idea is that the better you are at the game, the more of that story you'll engage with, and hopefully that as much as the getting 30 out of 30 will be a motivation for you to try to collect these things.
Right. Yeah.
Is to learn more about the world.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, like in Hollow Knight, I think that a large part of the drive, actually in all Metroidvanias, I think a lot of the part of the drive is to like explore a new area and like get access to that new area. So like. Metroid games, they have environmental storytelling in that, like, when you get into a new area, like, it's completely different from the last one, and you have to engage in that mechanically in a lot of different ways, but also just, like, visually, it's very different. Like, I can't come up with any worlds in Metroid right now. But, you know, the lava ones and the ice ones.
Yep, the one that where bats come after you and stuff.
Yes, bats and things. Yeah, you know, they all feel different.
Yeah.
And those can be motivators to keep going and keep playing through it and finding more aspects of the game.
Yeah, in games like that, because they tend not to have cutscenes.
Yes.
I mean, they will sometimes, but I think the tradition of them is that they don't have very many.
Mm-hmm.
And so it tends to be like the principal method of storytelling.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. It's really, I like that a lot. I like that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think Hollow Knight does a really good job of that.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
For all the problems I've had with that game, it does feel like, you feel very comforted that the world is designed and will unfold to you if you engage with it, honestly. Like, it doesn't, you never feel like, even though you do, there are a lot of secrets and things you have to discover, and it's a very challenging game, you never feel like that anything is going to be held back from you. You trust that it will come to you as it comes to you.
Yes.
And I think that's a real achievement for that kind of game.
Yes.
You know?
That's what you want from Metroidvanias.
Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, that's because, you know, we've described Widget Satchel as a Metroidvania light. Mm-hmm. It plays on some of those same kinds of engagements.
It does.
For sure.
Yeah.
The other example that I'm doing is in Metro Nexus, and I've talked about this on the show before, is my world maps all have different station names,
right? Yeah,
that imply this near future world.
Yes,
and I don't remember which episode I talked about it, but I talked about it for a long time, so you can go back and listen to that. Where it's sort of I'm trying to build this world, but it that one is a little bit more inscrutable. Like you have to sort of it's something more to discover, and it's less an element of the game on it. It's subtext.
Yeah,
I think. Mm.
Yeah,
and I think that knowing when to make it text and when to make it subtext is a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
Right. Like we solve it by in Widget Satchel it's text and in Metro Nexus it's subtext. There's no, you know, it's all one or nothing. But I think games that can blend those, I think that's a real challenge. And I can't think of a ton of great examples, but you kind of know when you see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. That's our ideal for Fingence, is that like if you're really paying attention to stuff, you'll pick up on the actual narrative of the game. Though we probably need to like, you know, explain a small part of the narrative of the game, because we don't do any of that in the game right now. We just tell people.
Mechanically, the game is so arcade pure.
Right.
And that's a strength of it.
Yes.
But I think you've always wanted there to be more cutscenes and more story stuff. Yes. You just haven't gotten around to making it yet. And in the meantime, the game has evolved in its current form to be really arcade pure.
Yeah.
And so you guys have had an interesting crossroads.
Yup.
Right? Because if you do bring that back in that initial vision, suddenly it starts changing what the game is.
A little bit, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so we'll have to think about that.
I don't mean to depress you or anything.
No, I've been thinking about, oh boy, and as an aside, I've been thinking about Fingence. Lane's going to hear this. Lane, I've been thinking about Fingence. and I've been thinking that like I want to work on it more than just like release it as soon as possible. I want to like add to it more.
Uh-oh, he's going to be very excited to hear that.
Yeah, he'll be fine with that. Charles, I'm sorry. well, just because, like, I don't know, I've been seeing other games, and I finally released a game, Clawbreaker's out, and that felt really good.
So you scratched that itch.
Yeah, I guess a little bit.
So now,
you know,
so now
game
you can go back and just work on a game forever now.
And never release it. No, one day we will release Fingence, but I don't know if that day is soon.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying.
Right. You're mulling greater hopes for it.
Yeah. I have been thinking that.
Yeah. Because I think I feel the same way about Metro Nexus. Mm-hmm. Like at a certain point you're like, I've been working on this game for too long. I need to like just make my checklist and finish it and get it out.
Yeah.
And you've probably been in that mode for Fingence for quite a while.
Yes.
But you're probably now that you haven't worked on it that frequently in the past couple months.
Maybe I'm inspired and want to put more stuff in it.
And that might be part of it, right? Is that you're now rediscovering the sort of like imaginative goals you had rather than the real, like, you know, rubber meets the road when you're working on it, you just want to finish it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's the right answer is like a balance of those things,
of course.
Right? Like you don't want to just shove it out the door.
No.
But you also, you know, can't just let it simmer for eternity.
Yes. I haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah.
Well, I got to talk to the team.
Mm-hmm. But I think that, I mean, in the context of, I mean, you're talking about like the narrative elements.
I was, yes.
That's the part that you really want to beef up.
I want to add a lot to that. Yeah, a large part of that.
Yeah.
Because like the gameplay is pretty dang solid.
Yeah, so. I think so.
So, that would be great.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, what other ways have we found that have been good, like environmental storytelling? Or at least what we could try to put in our games. I know we talked about Widget Satchel and Fingence.
Mm-hmm.
Martha, you're making a point and click.
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this a lot because I want there to be like lots of little hints in the background just about like the world that they live in and stuff like that. Like, I want there to be like lots of photographs on, or not photographs, but like paintings on the wall with different people in them, or like, and different things that if you click on them, like they'll say, oh, that's so-and-so or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Humongous games, whenever you click on something, even if it's not something that you're like going to pick up or whatever, some weird little thing will happen.
Yeah.
Like a banana will come out of a book or, you know, someone will come like clean the window if you click on the window, or like some little dragon will fly out from behind it. Like it's very silly little things that are just like weird, weird.
They're
things.
Non-sequiturs.
Non-sequiturs.
That,
exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Maybe like that appeal to the audience that thing's aimed at. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what's cute about those elements.
Yeah, exactly. It's like exactly how a kid thinks is like, totally not. It's like, oh, that looks kind of like an airplane. Oh, let's just make it an airplane and have it fly around the room.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So yeah.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
One of the nice things about environmental storytelling is that like you don't have to engage on it if you don't want to. And so it allows players who just want to deal with who just want to play the game to like not engage with it if they feel mm-hmm. like it. But like if you want to engage with it on that level, you can't.
I think that's a common way to describe it.
Sure.
But I feel that doesn't give it enough credit, I think.
Okay.
Or it lets game makers off the hook. I think
sure.
that kind of storytelling,
yeah.
The point of it is that it's not shoved at, it's not thrown at you.
Yes.
But it really, I believe it should be designed in a way that is appealing so that most players
oh, yeah.
will want it.
Yes.
Or at least engage with some of it. The idea that you could tell a player like, you could ignore all of it and just whatever, I feel like that's selling your game short in a way. And if you don't attempt to make that stuff, I'm trying to like balance what I'm saying here, like, because it is optional, right? It is yeah. contextual. It's yeah. not, it, you know, but at the same time, if you design it with the thing, with saying like, well, we can't make this like too upfront or players will get annoyed by it. Like, yeah. I think you just have the wrong idea about what your game is.
Sure. Right? Well, yeah, yeah, I agree. Like, if you implement environmental storytelling poorly, then like either the players feel like it's a cutscene, in which case you cannot ignore it. Which
yeah.
is, I mean, that's fine. You can have cutscenes in mm-hmm. your game, but like it's not an environmental.
You hear that, everyone? Thing. Steven's giving you permission.
Yeah, that's fine.
if you do it like poorly in a way where like no one is interested, then just no one is engaging with that and in that on that level that, yeah. at all, which mm-hmm. is bad. Yeah. So like, I'm not trying to tell people that like you should not do a good job doing this. I'm just saying that like.
Mm-hmm.
There are players, probably such as myself, who will ignore your narrative.
Yeah.
And
it's going to happen. Steven will ignore your narrative.
Yes. And as a result, the environmental storytelling will allow them to skip it if they want to.
Yeah. I think this is touching on maybe when we were brainstorming about topics, and you mentioned at the top
yes.
that we were going to call this environment as mechanics.
Right.
And then I've also forgotten exactly what we were talking yeah. about when we were talking about that. But I think we're getting close to it with this, where it's mm-hmm. like, is it just story elements, or is it stuff you engage with? Right? And is it... I guess the widgets have the example I'm thinking of, where like the collection mechanic is also the environmental storytelling.
Yeah.
Right? It's not apart from that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a very simple mechanic. I mean, it's not very complicated, but, right. like, it's tied to the mechanics of the collecting.
Yeah. It's like Myst, where all the puzzles are actually, like, environmental storytelling. Yeah,
exactly. That's a really, really good example.
Mm. I'm not very familiar with Myst.
Well, each of the puzzles, like you don't, sometimes don't even realize that you're working on a puzzle sometimes, mm-hmm. or, like, you don't, like, there's all these... Like, there is no story told at you, really.
Mm-hmm.
So you get all of it through, like, how the puzzles are built.
Okay.
Like, there's this part with the fish, who, like, that's a whole narrative about the fish. Like, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to describe it. Maybe you can describe it better.
The one I'm thinking of is from Uru, where there's a world where you actually travel through time to different eras of this world. In order to solve the puzzle, you go to this time, but you don't know which time is forward or back. You just you just go to different times,
okay.
and you have to piece together which one is before the other.
Oh.
And that's a puzzle.
Yeah.
But also, then you start learning about the story of this place. You see,
sure.
you see a tower that was once grand fall to ruins.
Yeah.
And then you understand what it was for and why it fell. And is it a tragedy, or is it just like the ravages of time? Like,
uh-huh.
was there a war, or was it just environment? That, you know, like, those things are interesting, and they are, that knowledge is what you need to solve the puzzle.
Yeah.
And so I think that the Myst series, there's more examples, but that's the one I'm thinking of,
sure.
where like that context, you understanding it, at least at a surface level, is the mechanic,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that is like something that we should all hope for when we add these kinds of things, which isn't to say you can't use a light touch,
right?
But like making it so that it's essential to, or maybe not essential exactly, but it's part of the story,
yeah.
or part of the experience, and not aside from the experience.
Yeah, yeah. You get more out of the game, not just like narratively, but also mechanically, if you pay attention to those kinds of things.
Yeah.
is what mm-hmm. I'm hearing. Yeah, yeah. That makes a lot of sense. That would be great. We should do that stuff for Fingence. How would we do that? If yeah. we made it...
Well, there's a really good, easy way to do that, which is you have your enemies, yes. right? And each some of the enemies are vulnerable to certain attacks.
Right.
For the most part, you can just shoot anything. Mm-hmm. But there are some that have homing weapons. There are some that have different patterns.
Yeah.
There are ways to reveal how those things work. Or you have bosses in the game that you have to suss out their patterns. And they're yeah. all expertly designed. Mm-hmm. But like, wouldn't it be nice to get hints as to how to attack them earlier
that.
In the game.
We do that, yeah. yeah? Well, a little bit. Yeah, because like in the Kelp Forest again, we have the three gruff catfish.
Yeah.
Where they have helmets made of rock,
mm-hmm.
And you can't shoot through them.
Yeah.
But earlier in the game, there are fish that are just covered in rock that you cannot shoot through yeah. as well. And so like, we hope that it'll teach players that like you cannot deal damage to this aspect, this part of the
right game. Right, that's introducing a mechanic and then paying it off,
I suppose.
Yeah. I think that's the thing, that is pretty close to this, and that I guess that's my point, is that yeah. they're not different,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
But like I'm thinking of some of the bosses that have different patterns and what to expect from them. I can't exactly describe how you might tease these things,
sure.
but you know, you have dialogue that the characters say in between levels, and
yes.
presumably if you have interstitial cutscenes where they, you know, where the characters talk about the enemies they're going to face,
yeah.
and you know, like this is the boss up ahead, and here's what we hear about him and stuff like that. Like those kinds of things can give the player hints to how to deal with them mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they can, yeah. and again, they can be kind of light, and they can be something that the player can. It's because the best moments are when the player's like, oh, like mm-hmm. you know, like in a way that's separate from just observing the boss or the behaviors,
yeah.
but in the like. Oh, from before. Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it makes them feel smart too.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, that's the real trick.
Yeah,
to game devs. To game dev life, make them feel smart.
Yeah, and like what Martha, you were saying about the hub world stuff. Like when you uncover secrets, you know in your heart that they're meant to be found, but you still feel like you did something special.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, I'm the only one who ever found this. All and ever in the world, and the developers didn't even know it was there.
I believe it. You're pretty smart.
That's a great note to end on.
That's our show. If you haven't already, subscribe to Nice Games Club in your favorite podcast app. Be sure to give it a good review if you liked it, or a nice like us. We need to know you're out there, so leave a review and tell all your friends too. We also want to hear directly from you, so follow us on Twitter and all the other things at Nice Games Club. And you can email us with your topic suggestions and so forth at contact@nicegames.club. Lastly, you can find out more about the show and your nice hosts, as well as get all the links and show notes from this and other episodes at nicegames.club. So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Yes, I had another one last point to make, though.
Okay.